Hi, I'm Rebecca Davis.
And I'm April Fulton. Welcome to Your Health, the weekly podcast from NPR's Science Desk. This week, we've got sleep-deprived teens.
And the challenges one state is facing with its very obese population.
And a closer look at the skull repair surgery that Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords had this week.
And we'll talk to our ever chipper health blogger, Scott Hensley. I just had to make sure he was looking chipper today. He is.
Indeed.
But first, we take a look at a chronic problem among teenagers, which is a lack of sleep. Research has shown that depression rates in teens go up as their hours of sleep go down. Reporter Michelle Trudeau says there are ways to deal with this sleep deficit that builds up in teens throughout the school week.
Your high schooler's chronically tired, right? Stays up late every night, surveys say close to midnight, finishing homework, texting friends, screen time, doing whatever teenagers do. And then has to get up early, typically 6, 6:30 for school the next morning. Happens 5 days a week with your teen getting more and more tired. Then comes the weekend.
Every parent of a teenager knows that if you try to get them up in the morning on the weekends, they are tired, grouchy, irritable, and not the charming individuals that they're capable of being because they're so exhausted.
That's sleep expert Helene M. Selim, a neurologist at George Washington University who has literally written the book on teenage sleep issues. She says the typical high school senior gets about 7 hours of sleep on school nights, and yet...
Most studies that have been done have shown a fairly consistent 9.25-hour sleep requirement. So there's a huge gap between what they're getting on an average school night and what they require.
As teens progress through puberty, unprecedented growth in body and brain requires lots of sleep. And there's something else changing. The very brain chemical that makes one feel sleepy, melatonin, is released later and later in the evening as teens get older. Because of this shift, says sleep researcher Stephanie Crowley from Rush University, teenagers just don't feel sleepy till later at night.
So compared to, say, a 10-year-old, a 16- or 17-year-old might be able to stay awake later compared to a 10-year-old that will likely fall asleep on the couch watching TV.
Result? By the end of each school week, your average teenager has accrued as much as 5 to 10 hours of sleep debt, which brings us back to the weekends.
What the majority of adolescents do is they will try and recover their sleep on the weekends. What usually will happen is they'll stay up late to socialize with friends and then sleep in the morning.
But this pattern makes things worse, not better. Again, Helene M. Selim.
So even if you catch up by sleeping in late on your weekend mornings, by doing so, it makes it harder for you to fall asleep by 10 or 10:30 on Sunday night, and you start all over again sleep restricted.
But M. Selim offers some suggestions for the weekends, based on her research in the lab and raising three daughters.
I honestly, as a parent myself, feel like a criminal if I ask them to get up at 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning. But I do try to get them to get up by 9. And I encourage them to get up and get some activity and some light exposure in the morning.
M. Selim calls light a drug that promotes wakefulness in the morning, in the same way that darkness can promote sleep.
In the evening, after 9 o'clock at night, I try to have them dim down the lights, minimize light exposure.
Literally, turn off some lights in the house and make a transition to sleep, like take a warm shower. And there are some don'ts.
Don't run, do homework, talk to everybody, text message everybody, leap in bed, turn out the lights, and expect yourself to fall asleep.
And when teens can't fall asleep, getting frustrated just lying there.
This is where some of their electronics used really carefully can be helpful. Listening to a soothing playlist with the lights out. Listening to a book but setting a timer on it for 30 minutes.
And two more tips. No caffeine, no chocolate after 2 p.m. And try to get an early afternoon nap, both on the weekends and during the week.
I encourage teens, if they have a break during the day, to use that study hall or break, if they're permitted to, for a 20-minute nap. Particularly, by the way, if they have a test in the afternoon, the studies have shown they'll do better on their test with a nap midday.
And they will have more energy and concentration to power through their homework later in the evening. For NPR News, I'm Michelle Trudeau.
Okay. Well, hi, Scott. Welcome.
Hey there.
Hi.
So we just heard about teens who don't get enough sleep, and we know from experience that they kind of turn into zombies. But you had a post this week that was actually about zombies, what to do when they attack. Really?
Really. I've got to hand it to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on this one. They took a subject that can be dull and a little off-putting for people, how to prepare for disasters or emergencies. Who wants to really think about a tornado and earthquake? And so they took the edge off by saying, well, why don't you get ready for the zombie apocalypse?
No way. So is it like the same advice as for tornadoes or what?
Pretty much. You know, you got to make sure you have enough food. You've got to have a place to meet in case your family gets separated. Think about sheltering in place or how you would evacuate. And, you know, they did it in a way that imparts some pretty useful information, and I think had some fun with it, and it ran like wild on the internet. So I suspect they were happy with the result.
But were they feeling a little lonely over there at the CDC? They need some attention.
Maybe they've got a new media guru over there.
Maybe there are zombies looking over their shoulders. I don't know.
What I really want to know is what they recommended for zombie apocalypse. Are those the same tips we need to remember for like an alien invasion?
I think it would all apply, yeah. And one of the things that I liked also was they said what they would do if, in fact, the zombies did invade. What would their role be? And so, you know, just like any other epidemic or infectious disease, they would try and quarantine people and investigate the cause and figure out if there was some kind of bug that was causing it. So, you know, maybe we'll see a cameo by the CDC in the next zombie movie.
Let's ask Steven Spielberg the next time he works on this issue.
Right, we need to get a zombie expert in here.
Yeah, let's stay tuned for that next week.
Well, I also saw a post this week from you, Scott, about some health professionals who want Ronald McDonald, the icon really that represents McDonald's, to retire. What's wrong with Ronald McDonald?
To hundreds of doctors and nurses, Ronald McDonald is the symbol of McDonald's marketing to kids, which they object to. That this the fast food choices that McDonald's represents, they say, are a threat to children's health, obesity epidemic, rising rates of diabetes, and things like that. So they called in an open letter to the company's CEO just ahead of the annual meeting for Ronald McDonald to go away and for the company to step back from the way that it markets food to kids.
So what was the reaction to that?
Well, the result was the company CEO defended choice and the company's marketing of its products as its right in a capitalist society, and that a related measure that we previously reported about on the blog, brought by some nuns outside, you know, in Philadelphia, asking the company to do a report on its response to childhood obesity, that only got 6% of the shareholder vote. So it was defeated. So basically, the company stood by its guns. The nuns say, well, we didn't expect that this was going to necessarily get approved the first time out, and they're looking at it as a way to engage a company in a dialogue about changing some of its practices.
Well, speaking of ways companies are looking at changing their marketing, there's a big marketing change coming to prescription drugs, Scott.
That's right. I talked with Michelle Norris this week on All Things Considered about the wave of brand name drugs that are going generic.
So and what drugs are we talking about here?
Well, the big one that's the focus now is Lipitor. I think most people have heard of that.
The
best-selling drug to lower cholesterol.
We sure have.
And if all goes as scheduled, right after Thanksgiving this year, that drug will lose its U.S. patent protection and become generic. And while the price won't drop dramatically at that point, it'll fall a little bit. And 6 months after that, there'll be a whole flood of companies competing to try and make Lipitor and sell it more cheaply. And it's an example of a big change right now in the drug industry, where all these brand name drugs that got launched and became household names in the 90s are losing their patents and becoming generic. So big savings for consumers, and it'll also change that there won't be as many ads for Lipitor coming soon.
So why are they all coming off?
Yeah, that's what I want to know.
At the same time.
What she said, yeah.
Right. The 90s was an incredibly productive time for the drug industry. Now we're all focused on how hard it is for them to come up with new drugs. And while it was never easy, so many of the medicines that have become household names were produced and launched during the 90s. Zoloft, Lipitor, Zocor, Zithromax, the antibiotic, all of these drugs that were, you know, kind of in their heyday then. Now the patents have expired, and the focus of the industry now has shifted to specialty medicines for specialty conditions that you might not have heard of unless you happen to have hepatitis C or multiple sclerosis. Mm. And many of these other drugs are for the kinds of conditions that would lead people to go see their primary care doctor and say, oh, my blood pressure is high, or I've got high cholesterol, or my asthma is acting up. So it's kind of a shift from these big name primary care oriented drugs, which had their heyday, and now the patents, which last around 10 or 12 years, are slipping away.
It sounds like a sea change for the industry, the way you're describing it. Is it that big? I mean, in terms of what their focus is.
I would say so. And it's been happening gradually, but as with Lipitor, which is kind of the flagship for that old model now going generic, that really kind of highlights the change.
Well, that's really interesting. As usual, Scott, thank you.
My pleasure.
So you can read more at www.npr.org/shots. And we'll talk to you next week. Bye.
See you then.
Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords of Arizona has been slowly recovering from an assassination attempt in January, and she's been living without a piece of her skull since then. But she had surgery this week to replace that missing piece with a plastic implant. All Things Considered host Michelle Norris talks with Dr. Peter Nakaji about what the surgery entails. Dr. Nakaji is the director of the neurosurgery residency program at the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix.
Dr. Nakaji, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michelle.
Could you quickly outline today's procedure for us?
Well, what would usually happen is that they'll reopen the incision that they made in the first place and expose the skull and find the edges. And then they'll take that implant, which should be perfectly custom-made for her, and just drop it right in almost like a puzzle piece.
Should we assume that there's a certain amount of risk associated with a surgery like this?
Yeah, every surgery has risks, and the major ones for this surgery are infection of the implant, because it's a foreign object, or bleeding. But in overall, this is a relatively safe surgery, much less complicated than the surgery she went through before to take out the bone flap.
Mm-hmm. And we noted that Congresswoman Giffords is receiving a plastic implant, meaning that the original piece of her skull was too damaged to put back in?
Yeah, usually in a gunshot wound case, the bone is so fractured that it's difficult to put it back in a meaningful way, or that it's been contaminated by the bullet and it's just not safe to put it back in for fear of infection. So this would be a very common thing to do.
Does this mean that that plastic implant will be permanent? Is that something that Congresswoman Giffords will live with for the rest of her life?
Yes, there will be a plastic implant in there. It may be incorporated into her own bone, but ultimately it will be there forever.
What do you... it's an odd question, but if it's there forever, then we assume that the piece of skull that was removed, that will not be replaced, that will not be put back.
Right. That bone, typically, once we're sure that the other one is taken, it'll be taken out of the freezer and, with the family's permission, it'll be discarded.
Mm. She's been able to move about. She's been quite mobile wearing that helmet. Why would she keep that headpiece on? I imagine that's to protect a part of her head, her brain that was exposed.
Right. As tough as your scalp is, it's still not as strong as your skull, which would otherwise be underneath protecting your brain. So you do have to have some kind of external protection against a blow to the head. So that's the purpose of that. But as soon as the bone flap is replaced, she can come out of that helmet.
Now, I understand that you've done a procedure much like this just this week.
Yeah, we had a case to replace one on Monday and a case actually for a very similar case also this week. So it is something that we do here relatively commonly.
Hopeful development.
Yeah, I think it's all good. It's all good. And I think it's a good milestone for the congresswoman.
It's, as we noted, and many people will remember, the shooting took place back in January. We're some months forward now. Do you have to wait this long to make sure that all the swelling has gone down?
Right. You can't sort of push the brain back into the head. You have to wait for it to swell up, and then it will gradually sink back into the head. And once it's done that and the normal contour is there, that's the best time.
Tell me about the recovery process from something like this.
You know, there's two parts of the recovery process. I think the first is that the scalp just has to be opened and closed again, and that's relatively straightforward healing, much like plastic surgery would be. The other part of it is the incorporation of the bone, and that takes a lot longer. But the last part really is the psychological part. This is usually when people start to feel like they're really on the road to recovery, because they look in the mirror and they see themselves again instead of someone they didn't expect to see.
Hmm. And is this where a certain sort of mental toughness kicks in? Because we keep hearing again just how hardy Congressman Giffords has been.
Yeah, definitely. It helps at every stage of recovery. But in some ways, this is the hard part. The drama part is gone a little bit, and now it's the facing the long, hard slog to recover. But this is the part that I always tell the families. This is where you really need to buckle down, because this is where the hard work begins, but really where the great gains are made, too.
That's Dr. Peter Nakaji. He's a neurosurgeon at Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix, Arizona. Doctor, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michelle.
Mississippi is struggling. Its citizens are the heaviest in the country, and a lot of them have health problems to boot. Debbie Elliott takes us to Holmes County, the poorest and heaviest in the state.
In Mississippi, 44% of kids are either overweight or obese. First Lady Michelle Obama stopped there on her Let's Move campaign.
Too many kids in this country don't get enough exercise, and they aren't as healthy as they need to be. And if we're honest with ourselves, as all of you know, we know that here in Mississippi, kids struggle with these issues sometimes even more than in other parts of the country.
And so, to begin our reporting on America's battle with obesity, NPR's Debbie Elliott takes us to the front lines in Holmes County, Mississippi.
You can see some of what Mrs. Obama is up against with the stop at the Double Quick. Part gas station, part convenience store, part lunch counter, Double Quicks are everywhere in the Mississippi Delta. In many small towns, it's one of the few places to get a hot meal.
We have baked chicken, gravy liver, fried livers, gizzard, potato logs, chicken on a stick, tenders, corn dogs, piece of sticks, okra, and we have some fish coming up and shrimp. And some fried pies for your dessert.
The clerk, Renee Hart, says today's fried pie is filled with strawberry cream cheese, and the fish and shrimp are fried too. Peering through the plexiglass food case, Dan March chooses fried chicken with a side of fried okra.
That's good enough for a poor man, isn't it?
He's a regular customer here.
Well, I need baked chicken, but I love fried chicken.
And that's where the obesity battle starts, that endless struggle between what we need and what we love. Holmes County is a gateway of sorts, where the rolling hills of East Mississippi give way to the flat, fertile plain that is the Mississippi Delta. It's a region with a history as rich as the soil, but with deeply rooted social problems. Holmes is the poorest county in Mississippi, with 48% of residents living in poverty. 4 out of 10 people here are obese, the highest rate in the state. And you see it all around. Large kids lumbering to get on the school bus, patients spilling over their seats in the doctor's waiting room. The statistics are heartbreaking, says Sandra Shelson, executive director of the Partnership for a Healthy Mississippi.
I think now for the 6th year in a row, we remain the most obese state in what is the most obese country in the world, I guess, making Mississippi the most obese place in the world.
Mississippi may top the list, but its southern neighbors are close behind. The top 10 fattest states are all in the South. We might enjoy our food, Shelson says, but
it's much more complex than that, than just that we like our fried chicken.
She says part of it is psychological. When you look around and see that most other people look like you, it doesn't register that you might have a problem. Gracie Williams is a cook at the Double Quick.
To me, overweight is when you go on past 300 something and you're having a hard time walking and breathing. That's when you're overweight.
Standing near the noisy deep fryers, she says she's been holding her own.
Me, for the last 5 years, I've been the same weight. I ain't gained a pound, I ain't lost a pound. And I'm still, consider myself being pretty good.
Pretty good for her is 265 pounds on a 5'5" frame. At 47, Williams has had diabetes for 15 years now. I ask about the size of her 3 grown daughters.
I got one thin daughter. She real thin. My oldest daughters, all of us know we're healthy. My baby's healthy.
Healthy meaning heavy, and that's a common reference in the Delta. Heavy is healthy.
We tend to look at body image different from other states.
Rochelle Culp works for a nonprofit trying to get a healthy message to her native Holmes County. It's a personal fight for her. Her father was an obese smoker and died when he was just 36 years old. That motivated her to lose more than 100 pounds. Cause for celebration in most parts, but something that can still prompt a different reaction here.
Oh, you need to keep on a couple of pounds. You're looking frail or thin. And we like to associate this term, it's a country term, fine. And fine most times means you have a few extra pounds on.
Culp meets me in Chula, Mississippi, a little town built around the railroad tracks that cut through the cotton and soybean fields of Holmes County. This used to be a thriving agricultural center, but now jobs are scarce. Just about all that's left of the town center is the public library, the drugstore, the hardware store, and a small supermarket. Culp leads me to what passes as the produce department.
We see a few sweet potatoes, a few white potatoes, I guess you could say, or Idaho potatoes, bananas, and few onions.
Nothing like the rainbow of fruits and vegetables you'd see piled high at a Whole Foods or a Kroger in the city.
It's funny that they have three selection of onions there, but not many other selections of fresh vegetables. And then we see here some beverages, and most of these are going to be high in sugar.
Right in the produce case, brightly colored bottles of sugary fruit drinks. They're called Little Hugs, and they're cheaper than buying an apple or one of the bananas that are starting to turn black. Culp and other advocates say it's no coincidence that the most obese state is also the poorest.
That'd be good for me. Let me just listen a bit. Deep breath.
In Holmes County, 15% of adults have diabetes, and that keeps the doctors busy. At the health clinic in Chula, Dr. David Gilder is examining Sally Johnson. She's 84 and suffers from diabetes. Her son Eddie tells the doctor she's getting up in the night sneaking ice cream and cookies. She grins.
Yeah, you know, my appetite stay good. It sure do.
Too good, huh?
Ms. Johnson promises to do better.
Well, I'm going to make her start backing up off that food.
Well, I tell you, that eating at night sure will make your blood sugar go up in the morning.
She's 5 feet tall and weighs 255 pounds. She needs a walker to get around. Mrs. Johnson wasn't always this big. When she was younger, she worked on the farm.
Chopping cotton and picking cotton. That's what we were doing, farming on a plantation. But we don't do that no more. Now that she ain't get that cotton. Cotton picker, she ain't get it. We don't have to get it.
Machines do it now, but her fingers still come together as if pulling a bowl of cotton from its stem. The appetite that once sustained her and thousands of others through grueling labor is now their enemy. Dr. Gilder, who grew up in the Delta, sees it every day. Four of the first six patients on his roster today have problems related to obesity, diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure.
It's like a war.
And half the battle, he says, is just getting people to own up to the fact that their weight is the problem.
Calling someone obese, they don't like that very much. You know, it's a touchy subject. If you talk about the obese population, well, they're thinking about someone who weighs more than me, no matter what they weigh. But it's a national problem. Holmes County's maybe the worst, but it's tough. It's tough to deal with.
Even tougher when it's children, he says. Like a 75-pound four-year-old.
When I see them, I see the next 20 years. You know, sometimes this is what's going to happen. This is your dad or your grandmother, and that I'm treating for diabetes, hypertension, heart failure, so many things, and this is where it's leading. But it's probably going to be 10 or 15 years earlier in that patient.
Obesity is not just a problem for the poor, mostly African-American communities in the Delta. Just look to the Mississippi state capital. Republican Haley Barbour is the governor. He's famously said, if you see him drop 40 pounds, you'll know he's running for president. He was about halfway there when he decided not to run. And he's not the only lawmaker looking to shed the extra pounds.
All right, jumping jacks, ready to go! Let's get moving. Let's get moving.
Trainer Paul Lacoste is leading a 6 a.m. boot camp for state lawmakers, lobbyists, and government workers at Jackson State University. That's Steve Holland's grunt as he makes rapid step-ups onto a riser. He's the longtime chairman of the Mississippi House Public Health Committee and used to weigh a whopping 359 pounds. He's lost 140 after bariatric surgery and coming to these early morning workouts with fellow lawmakers.
Mother of God, tell me about it.
Later, at his Capitol office, sitting beneath a sign that says, "Lobbyists don't feed the chairman," Representative Steve Holland says Mississippi needs to change.
We have a culture of easy living, good eating with fat back and lard and things like that. And we like to sit on our porch and we like our adult beverages and we like our fellowship and that kind of thing. And when you put all that together over generations, you've got a bad health problem.
And nobody seems to have the answer to what to do about it. The state has improved nutrition requirements in public schools and child care centers, but a push for a tax on sugar-sweetened soft drinks can't get traction. And Governor Barbour vetoed a bill that would have created a statewide obesity council to tackle the problem. Holland, a Democrat, says the sweating legislators are trying to lead by example. But he concedes that Jackson is a far cry from Holmes County. The tiny towns in the Delta don't have gyms or even sidewalks, much less personal trainers paid for by Blue Cross Blue Shield like their boot camp.
And that's the sad commentary on it, and I worry as a public policy maker. I don't know what you can do about it except make it attitudinal across the state.
Fitness is sort of like happiness, he says. It's homemade. And people here don't want the government in their kitchen, says Sandra Shelson with the Partnership for a Healthy Mississippi.
What are you going to do now? You know, you're telling me not to smoke in my office building. What are you going to do? You're going to monitor how many Big Macs I can have? There is this whole attitude somehow that even if it's good for you, that there are things that are hands-off, even if it's going to kill me.
My hip.
Give me some fried chicken and turnip greens and peas.
Here at the Double Quick, talk of regulating food, not a good idea.
I don't think you can legislate how somebody eats.
Rick Buning is vice president of food service for the Double Quick chain.
I always ask myself before we put anything out there, what does our customer want? And, you know, we've seen people talk healthy, but they eat differently. It's still, you know, their choice.
In the end, he says they want traditional Southern foods and a lot for the money. And the Double Quick delivers. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Chula, Mississippi.
And that's all for Your Health. We've got production help from Giselle Grayson.
Thanks, Giselle.
And we'll be back again next week with more from Your Health.
See ya.